everybody. We are ready to do integration today. You may think I had to wait until grad studies and integration. Right, so we do integration in great generality today. I already mentioned earlier that the reason why we are interested in, we ought to be interested in differential forms is that they will be crucial for the purpose of integration. And here's how that goes. Let us ask, what is special about totally antisymmetric covariant tensors? Which is to say, what is special about differential forms? Well, they are antisymmetric, totally antisymmetric. And that means that they will have particular transformation properties under charge changes. And from the physicist's perspective, charge changes tell us something about the scalar, vectorial, tensorial character of our maps. And that combines with antisymmetry to something very special, as we will see in a moment. Reason being that under charge changes, in ordinary integration over Rn, we know that we get a chain rule factor, which is the determinant of the Jacobian matrix, which is to say the first derivatives matrix from the new to the old coordinates. The antisymmetry of the differential forms will match the antisymmetry in the determinant. And that is ultimately the reason why differential forms are the things that we need to integrate. So I gave you the general intuition for this, but there is one caveat, which is that the antisymmetry guarantees that there is a match with the antisymmetry in the chain rule factor in the determinant of the Jacobian. But there is one more concept that we have to match. Namely, we have to consider the notion of orientation. Consider, for example, a one-dimensional manifold. We will integrate over one-dimensional manifolds, such as this line here, two-dimensional, three-dimensional, any dimension. And in the simplest case, it's just one dimension. That's the manifold. And in order to integrate over it, we need a chart so that we can reduce integration over the manifold to an integration over Rn. In this case, it's one-dimensional. So using a chart, we have a map into R. And so we want to express integration over our one-dimensional manifold as an integration over an interval in R. But there are two ways to do this. If this is our one-dimensional manifold, which might, by the way, stand on its own, or it could be embedded as a path in a higher dimensional manifold. Either way, this one-dimensional manifold has a beginning and an end in our case here. And we could choose to map from that one-dimensional manifold into the real line in such a way that this point here, the P point, ends up being mapped onto the left end of the left end of the interval, and Q ends up being mapped onto the right end or the other way around. We could find another chart, another diffeomorphism from here to here, another coordinate system where P is mapped onto this end and Q is mapped onto that end. And of course, the points in between in a differentiable way somewhere in between. And you may wonder, well, that shouldn't make a difference. But remember that if we integrate from A to B over the real line, over an interval of the real line, then that's the same as minus integrating from B to A. So a minus sign is at stake here. And that's just the one-dimensional case. In general, the determinant of the Jacobian can be positive or negative, and that will give us an ambiguity here. So we'll need to fix this. Nothing particularly difficult, but we'll have to take care of it. Now, for n-dimensional manifolds, in general, one chart may not suffice. We may have to use several charts, And a complete collection of charts, if you remember, is called an atlas. An atlas is called oriented if among all of the overlapping charts with coordinates x and x tilde in the region in which they overlap have the property that their determinant of the change of chart Jacobian is positive. That means that the right-handed goes into right-handed. Okay, so we are not mapping a right-handed coordinate system into a left-handed. If, for example, you map R3 into R3 in such a way that the x, y, z coordinates go into x, z, y coordinates, then you get a minus sign over here. So we are saying that an atlas is oriented if this is always positive. So if the determinant of the Jacobian matrix, the derivative matrix from the new to the old variables, or vice versa, if that determinant is always positive. So we never have a left-right change whenever we swap charts. See, we're talking about the regions where charts are overlapping. And there where they are overlapping, we can change from one chart to the other, and we may incur a determinant which is positive or negative. If we have an atlas in which all of those determinants are positive, then we say it is oriented. A manifold M is called orientable if it possesses an oriented atlas. So for example, the Möbius strip wouldn't have that. Not orientable. Now, a manifold M, together with a choice of oriented atlas, is called an oriented manifold. So once we have such an atlas, an oriented atlas, where all the chart changes have positive Jacobian determinant, then we are free to choose any arbitrary chart on top of that. For example, ones that have an opposite orientation. And so we will then call an arbitrary chart to be with positive, to be either positive or negative relative to our oriented atlas if the Jacobian determinant going from the charts of our oriented atlas to our extra chart, whether that's positive or negative. So once we have an atlas, it sets the standard for what is positive by definition. Next, for integration, we will need the notion of volume form. It will come up in a moment again. The notion of volume form is very closely tied to the existence or non-existence of a volume form. First of all, what is a volume form? A volume form is a top form. It is in lambda n. So if our manifold is n-dimensional, then lambda n is the top, is a space of top forms. There cannot be any forms in lambda n plus 1. Lambda n plus 1 would be the set of totally anti-symmetric n plus 1 tensors, covariant n plus 1 tensors. But there can't be any other than 0. Because you can't anti-symmetrize n plus 1 of them if your basis has only n of them. So if you want to write down something completely anti-symmetric out of n elements, then you have to reuse one at least once. And then you get symmetry, and so that kills it all. So remember that there are no differential forms of rank larger than n, n being the dimension of the manifold. And in fact, this space at every point of the manifold, the space lambda n is just one-dimensional. Because there's only one way to anti-symmetrize n elements, the product of n elements, if there are n different ones of them. But of course, the space of all n-form functions is infinite dimensional. So among those, among the n forms, those are called volume forms which never vanish, or which are always positive, let's say. That will be a concept that is very useful, for example, for directly the purpose of calculating the volume of a chunk of the manifold. We will literally integrate over that volume form then, in a little later. But also it's interesting that the existence or absence of a volume form, a top form that's always positive, is in one-to-one correspondence to the manifold being orientable. It turns out if you have a volume form, you can define the orientation relative to it, or if you have orientability, then you have ways of generating volume forms. So it's a theorem that says that it's one-to-one correspondence. So now, let's look at this argument in detail. Why is it that the totally anti-symmetric covariant tensors are the ones that can be integrated? For that, let's look at change of coordinates in ordinary integration in Rn. So let's say that G, assume that G is a function over Rn. It's just a number-valued function over Rn. And we integrate that over some piece of Rn, either all of it or some piece of it, doesn't matter. And this is the ordinary integral as defined by Riemann's or Lebesgue's method. That's ordinary n-dimensional integral of a function over Rn, expressed in the coordinate system of x1 to xn. If we change coordinates to new coordinate system, x tilde 1 to x tilde n, then, please remember, from ordinary calculus of multiple variables, that in the new coordinate system, you obtain the same number if you integrate as follows. You integrate your function g, but now you have to evaluate it at the new coordinates. Right? So x is the coordinates corresponding to the point x tilde. So you're not changing the function g itself. You just have to check where you have to evaluate it. And you integrate over the dx tilde, but you also have to include this chain rule factor, which is this Jacobian matrix's determinant. And you can think of the origin of this in the following way. When you want to integrate this up, you really should think of this integral as being reduced to a sum, where you are summing over little boxes. And when you change, and you see, as the boxes get smaller and smaller, you approach the integral then, just like Riemann integration with the bars. Now, when you change coordinate system, your boxes get deformed. And if you ask, how does the volume of an infinitesimal box change under a nonlinear transformation, then if the box is really infinitesimal in size, then you only need to know of that nonlinear transformation of change of coordinates, you only need to know its first derivatives. These guys. They tell you how the volume of a little box changes as you change it in a linear fashion. But for tiny infinitesimal sized boxes, it's sufficient to know that tangent. And it's this factor that goes into it. Okay, so that is ordinary integration. Now, let's say we have a general n-dimensional differentiable manifold, M, and we consider an n form, so it's a top form, n is the dimension of the manifold, we consider a top n for, an n form omega, and we write it down in a coordinate system. Because it is an n form, it is a multiple of the basis in the space of n forms, but the space of n forms is one-dimensional. That's the only basis vector. At every point, At every point of the manifold, this is the basis vector. This is one basis vector in the space of n forms. As we discussed earlier, there's only one way that you can combine n different basis vectors in an antisymmetric way. Everything else is just multiples of it. If I swap those two, I just pick up a minus sign, but I get the same vector. So an n form is always a function times this basis vector. Can always be written in this way. Then let us ask, if we change chart from the chart given by the x's to the chart given by the x tildes, then how does the n form change its representation? Well, let's see. Let's work it out in detail. This is the one form over here, f of x times this wedge product of the dxi's. Now, as we change coordinates, the dx1 becomes a linear combination of the dx tilde i1. And the linear combination factors are these. As we discussed earlier on when we did the geometric definition, the physicist's definition of tangent vectors and cotangent vectors, we said that we can identify tangent vectors or cotangent vectors by the way that they change coefficients under change of chart. And that's what we established. Namely, that as you change chart, this basis vector in the cotangent space, you find out is this linear combination of basis vectors in the cotangent space, but with the new basis vectors, these guys. And so if you change the coordinate system, then these vectors can be written as this linear combination of that, and so on. This is a scalar function. It's in lambda naught. And as a scalar function, it doesn't change its value. You just have to evaluate it at the right point. It becomes x of x tilde. So in the new coordinate system, f is the same as what it was before. You just have to concatenate that and put the x tilde before. And so it's x of x tilde now. Now remember that the wedge product guarantees by construction that this expression is antisymmetric in the interchange of any two of those indices. Okay, so if I want to commute this one with that one, I can do so at the expense of having a minus sign. If I want to exchange this one with that one, no problem, it costs me a minus sign. Actually, a lot of those terms are zero. See that? And the reason is that dx1, for example, is a linear combination of, I mean, these are the linear combination coefficients, and these are the new basis vectors, right? And you see, the same is true for the second one. And they run through all of the basis vectors. So there's going to be a lot of cases where you have here, for example, dx3 and another dx3 here, or maybe another dx3 over there. But when you have two of the same kind in there, then you must have that the whole thing is zero, because it's totally antisymmetric. So in fact, most of those terms are zero, because they have one or more double occurrences of the same index, same basis vectors. Just because we sum over all i1, sum over all i2, sum over all in. So we get all possible distributions of the numbers from 1 to n in all of those here. They're not ordered in any particular way. And there's no guarantee that they don't agree with each other either. So most of these terms are zero. And the only terms that can survive in this huge sum here, the only terms that are surviving are those terms where among those indices i1 to in, the numbers 1 to n occur each only once. So there will be, for example, a term which is i1, i2, i3, where the i1, i2, i3 up to in are literally 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, until n. Another term that survives is where they are n, n minus 1, n minus 2, n minus 3, up until 1. Another term that will survive is where they are 1, 2, 3, 4, and then n, n minus 1, n minus 2, until, and so on. It's all possible perturbations of the set of, all possible permutations of the numbers from 1 to n. These are the sets of terms. This is the set of terms that survives here. But they're not really different terms. They're just permutations of each other, which means that they differ only by a minus sign at most. So two of those terms that arise in this huge sum are equal if they can be obtained from each other by an even number of permutations, because each permutation gives you a minus sign. And they will have a minus sign in between them if they can be obtained from each other by an odd number of permutations. So what we get is, we can choose, in this huge sum here, we can choose this to be 1, that to be 2, next one 3, up until n, and all the other terms are proportional to that. Sum with a minus sign, sum without. So we find that omega, the differential form, in the new coordinate system, is this factor. And then, that's just unchanged. And then we have the dx tilde 1 up until dx tilde n. And we have lots of terms in this way, all possible permutations. And they come with positive or negative signs, depending on whether they have an even or odd number of permutations in between them. And the prefactor is, except for the minus sign we just discussed, is this product of terms. Now, so we have a sum over these kinds of terms where the indices are running from 1 to n, and these here also are running from 1 to n in all possible perturbations with possible minus signs, depending on whether it's an odd or an even permutation. In other words, this is the Jacobi determinant. So, what we obtain is this. In a new coordinate system, the differential form, because it's totally anti-symmetric and because it is covariant, a covariant tensor, gives us this determinant. If we had chosen it to be contravariant tensors, we could have played the same game, but we would have had a minus sign in here. It would have been the inverse of that determinant. So now let us compare that with equation star from above, which we had when we just did integration over Rn, this one. You see, this is something we wanted to integrate. Under change of coordinates, we got that. Okay? So therefore, what that means is that the following definition of the integral of an n form over an n-dimensional manifold is consistent in the sense that it is independent of our choice of coordinate system. It's chart independent. The definition is that if M is an oriented n-dimensional manifold and omega is our n form, our volume form, and if omega in a chart takes this particular form, it's a scalar function times these basis vectors, then assuming that one chart suffices, and if one chart is not sufficient to cover the integration region, then you have to piece it together with several charts. But let's just say one chart suffices, then we define the integral over the n-dimensional manifold of the n form omega, which doesn't have to be a volume form, just some n form. We define this integral to be this integral here, where you choose a chart, x, and then you integrate over the image of the region that you want to integrate over, this function f with these coordinates. So you reduce, in this way, the abstract integration, which is an integral over an n-form over an n-dimensional manifold in the abstract to something very concrete, namely the usual Riemann or Lebesgue integral over some region in Rn defined in the usual way. And we know how that formula changes under change of charge. And we know how omega changes under change of charge. And so we made sure by construction that this definition is not actually charge dependent. So this, I write this down in one chart, but I could have written it down in any other chart, and I would have gotten the same number, same integral, because of the common transformation properties of, of n forms and Riemann integration in Rn. Right, so if one chart doesn't suffice, then we can piece it together by using several charts. The piecing together of charts is usually a relatively straightforward, almost trivial thing to do, except keep in mind that those charts should have Jacobians that have positive determinant. If not, well, then you have to keep track of it. And then you get a minus sign in your expressions. It's just like integrating, instead of integrating from in the real line from 5 to 10, you could also integrate from 10 to 5, but keep in mind that what you want is have an extra minus sign to take into account of having integrated the other way. Okay, so now we have integrals over n forms. We now know how to integrate n forms over n-dimensional manifold. And this also includes, of course, lower dimensional submanifolds of higher dimensional manifolds. For example, if your manifold is n-dimensional, you may have a submanifold in it, which is r-dimensional. Then what you can integrate with these methods over this r-dimensional submanifold is r forms, where r is smaller than n. The dimension of the space that you integrate always has to match the degree of the form that you want to integrate over it. Just by the way we defined it. We didn't define anything else. That's what you have to do. There's a way around that, and we will get this later in this course. Remember the co-boundary operator? The co-boundary operator was the exterior derivative, exterior derivation. Now let's define the boundary operator. So let's assume that G is some region in the manifold M. So it's an n-dimensional open and connected subset of our n-dimensional manifold. Now G being a region, I mean, for example, you could imagine M being R3 and G being a ball. Well, then we can look at the boundary of that ball. And the boundary of that ball is going to be a sphere. In the case of a three-dimensional ball, the sphere would be two-dimensional. In general, if G is some region in an n-dimensional manifold that is itself n-dimensional, then its boundary is going to be n minus one-dimensional. And we will denote the boundary of that region by del G. So G is the region, del G is the boundary of the region. So we're not differentiating or anything here. It just means take the boundary of that region. So it's a set of points on the manifold. And so we consider this to be an operator. This del is mapping regions into their boundaries. It's mapping n-dimensional manifolds into n minus one-dimensional manifolds. Now the boundary that we obtain is said to be smooth. And that's a technical condition in preparation for the theorem that we will cover in a moment. We say that a boundary is smooth if locally there always exist charts such that the boundary can actually be mapped into a straight line, a plane, or in any case, just Rn. So if locally there's a diffeomorphism into Rn of that boundary, then we say it is smooth. You see, if this thing had a kink in it, you couldn't do it in a differentiable way. But charts are diffeomorphisms. So if there is a coordinate system in which the boundary is just a sharp boundary in Rn, very smooth. So we call this boundary then smooth. It's really a property of the boundary of that region. It's not a property of Rn or anything. We call it this way. We call it smooth if such charts exist. So we'll in a moment get to one of my favorite theorems ever, Stokes' theorem. I'm sure you know it and you probably like it too. So here's the proposition. It's just a technical condition, again, in preparation for Stokes' theorem. If the manifold is orientable, remember what that means, it has an orientable atlas, an oriented atlas, which means that it has a set of charts whose Jacobian determinants are all positive. So if M is orientable, then the region G is also orientable. It's simply inheriting its orientation from M. And also, when G is orientable, then its boundary is also inheriting an orientation, and in particular is orientable. So finally, we have all the ingredients for Stokes' theorem. Stokes' theorem says this. Imagine G is a region in our n-dimensional manifold. And then close that region. It may not be closed, so close it, it's a technical thing. So you close your region, and if that is a compact n-dimensional region, then Stokes' theorem holds, and it relates in a very deep way differentiation to integration. Namely, Stokes' theorem says that if we take the differential form d omega and integrate it, or any differential form d omega, and integrate it over the region G, then this is the same as integrating the differential form omega over the boundary of that region, where omega is any n minus 1 form. Why n minus 1 form? Well, here we take the d of it, and that makes it an n form. And then that n form gets integrated over our n-dimensional region. Over here, we just have the n minus 1 form, and it gets integrated over the boundary, which has a dimension less, so it's n minus 1 dimensional. So this is happening. This is an integral over an n-dimensional manifold. That's an integral over an n minus 1-dimensional manifold. And you can remember this formula very simply if you keep in mind that, if you just memorize that the d, kind of the dual to the del. Because you have a choice here. You can either have a d on a differential form, or, and that is what Stokes says, you can have a del on the boundary. So basically, both do the same thing. You can either put a d on a differential form, evaluate that, get a number, or alternatively, put a del on the boundary, evaluate, get the same number. Now, since this has very justifiably the name of being the boundary operator, because it maps onto the boundary, this is called the co-boundary operator. This is a very general theorem, and you have seen already several special cases of it. Let us go through a few special cases so that you recognize what's going on. Oh, but before, let's play a little bit with it. It seems that Stokes is inviting us to iterate it. You see, this is an n-dimensional integral. That's an n minus 1-dimensional integral. What if we apply Stokes again? Then we should get to an integral that's over n minus 2 dimensions. And then we apply Stokes again, we get an integral over n minus 3 dimensions, until we're down to integrations over just one dimension, or perhaps zero dimensions. And it becomes trivial somehow. Wouldn't that be nice? Yeah, it's too nice to be true. We cannot iterate Stokes. Well, we kind of can, but it's useless. And here's why. So remember, we can shift, we can either put a D here or replace it by a del there, right? So a D on the differential form gives you the same as a del on the boundary. So let's try to iterate now. So let's say our region G is itself the boundary of a region H. Then by Stokes' theorem, we have this. Let's say we have the dd of omega. Then we can get rid of this d by instead putting a del on the differential manifold, right? Remember, that's how Stokes works. You can take that d away and instead put a del there. So by Stokes' theorem, we have that this is equal to that integral. And then we have this d, and we can, by Stokes, instead of putting a d on a differential form, put a del on the region that we integrate over. So we get rid of that d here, and we get a del del over there now. And of course, that's vanishing. D squared is zero. That's vanishing because the boundary of the boundary is an empty set. We're integrating over nothing here. The differential form may be non-zero, but the manifold has been reduced to nothing. So we get a triviality. We get 0 equal to 0. This is 0, that is 0. Well, so the thing in the middle has to be 0 as well. So it's true, but it's trivially true. But still, we see something very nice, which is that the boundary operator squared is vanishing, which is, if you remember, expresses simply the fact, the geometric fact, that boundaries don't have boundaries. Here, on the other hand, we have dd is equal to 0, which is something you can show on completely algebraic grounds. It has nothing to do with geometry. Just check what the definition is of the exterior derivative, apply it, and then apply it again, and you see that you get too much anti-symmetrization. You get some symmetrization and anti-symmetrization as you do it, and it kills the whole thing, and it's vanishing for purely algebraic reasons. So the Stokes theorem is very beautifully relating the fact that boundaries don't have boundaries to the fact that the co-boundary operator squared is also zero. So it relates something geometric to something algebraic. But it also means we can't iterate Stokes. So Stokes theorem implies that if d squared is equal to zero, that also means that del squared is equal to zero and vice versa. Another way to say that is that Stokes links homology, which is the study of geometry, to cohomology. You know, that was the algebraic definition.
I have a question.
Yeah?
What if the boundary has a k? Does it matter? Because differential forms are smooth objects, right?
Yes, we assume them to be smooth. I didn't go into those details. In principle, yes, there's some fine print there. But you can actually define it quite generally by piecing together pieces of the boundary. It doesn't strictly have to be smooth. So Stokes' theorem, special case number one. It turns out that the fundamental theorem of calculus is a special case of Stokes. Imagine that the manifold in question is R, and that the region that we are considering is the one-dimensional submanifold consisting of the open interval from A to B. And then let us look at the boundary of it. The boundary is obtained from the closure of it, if you remember. The boundary consists of the endpoints of the interval. See, the interval is one-dimensional, but the boundary is zero-dimensional. It's one point and another point. Individual points are zero-dimensional manifolds. Okay, so G is the interval from A to B. The boundary is the set of two points, A and B. Then Stokes' theorem, which is always this, says that if you take a differential form over the manifold, in this case it's the df over an interval, you get the same as if you took f and integrated it over just the boundary. So in our case, that's an interval. It's a one-dimensional integration. And that is a zero-dimensional integration. In practice, it's this. F is a function over the real line. Df is a cotangent vector field. It's a differential form. And what is it in practice? Well, df, if you remember, we can expand it in the basis of the dx. And it's this. It's df by dx, dx. That's the expansion of an arbitrary f, of an arbitrary df, in the canonical basis of the cotangent space. So this integral is that integral. G is the interval, and we have df here, and df takes that form, where df by dx is literally the derivative of f. And on the right-hand side, we have the function, but now it's to be integrated over the boundary, which is zero-dimensional. And, well, those diffeomorphisms, well, that's pretty simple. So it's just a map, and you just have to evaluate f at b and f at a, just the difference of the two. And that is, of course, just the fundamental theorem of calculus, that if you integrate the derivative of a function from a to b, you get the difference between f at b and f at a. Special case number two. Now we're working in two dimensions. This was one dimension. That's two dimensions. In two dimensions, there is a so-called Green's theorem. Have you heard of that? It comes up in electromagnetism sometimes. Imagine you have a manifold R2, and G is a region in it. And we assume that it has a boundary curve del G. It's, of course, closed, because boundaries don't have boundaries. So here's our region in R2, and del G is the boundary of it. Now our integration, our Stokes formula, is going to relate an integral over the two-dimensional region, and it's got to be a two-form that we're integrating here, to an integral over just the boundary, which is a one-dimensional region. Just like in the previous example, we had one-dimensional integral, one form, zero-dimensional integral, zero form. Just the function. So here we have a two-form that we integrate over the two-dimensional region, and then we integrate a one-form over the boundary. And how do we do that? Well, first we choose an arbitrary one-form, omega. Any one form in two dimensions can be written in this way. Coefficient function times first basis vector plus coefficient function times second basis vector. Your choice, what you choose for omega 1, what you choose for omega 2. Right? Omega 1 depends on x1 and x2. Omega 2 depends on x1 and x2. Arbitrary coefficient functions on the manifold. You get to choose your one form. It doesn't have to be closed or exact. Then, that's a one form. That's great. We can integrate that over the boundary. But if we now take the d of it, we get a two form. And that's great because we can integrate it over all of g. So let's calculate the exterior derivative of omega. We can do that by the Leibniz rule. Remember, this is really a zero form, veg a one form, plus zero form, veg a one form. It's just that the veg is usually omitted if one of the two factors is just a function. So by the Leibniz rule, for differential forms obeyed by the exterior derivative, we have that this is the d of omega 1. So we apply the d to the first factor, leaving the second factor the same. So we have this one form, veg that one form. plus, leaving that the same and applying the d onto that. But then we have a d squared of x1, but that goes away. So we have just one surviving term. We also have to apply the d on that thing. Again, by the Leibniz rule, we get the d applied to omega 2, leaving the second thing the same. But also we get a term where this one survives, but we apply the d to that, but it's a d squared, so it's vanishing. All right, so we get to these two terms. Now we can spell out what they are. D omega 1, if you remember, omega 1 is just a function. The differential of it can be expanded. It's d omega 1 by dx1 times the first basis vector plus d omega 1 by dx2 times the second basis vector, which dx1 is just carried forward. I just spelled out what this is in that bracket. And then I spell out what this is in that bracket. Two terms go away, namely dx1 veg dx1 is 0. And here dx2 veg dx2 is 0. So we are left with only this term and that term. Here they are. And notice we have here dx2, dx1, and dx1, dx2. They're really the same vector up to a minus sign. So we can reorder them. And then we get that the d omega is this. Now, we have omega, and we calculated the d omega. The omega was this, and the d omega is that. Stokes' theorem now tells us that if we integrate d omega, it's this differential form, over our region G, then it's the same as if we integrated the omega, the one form, over the boundary. Let me tell you just very briefly how. Okay, how would we actually evaluate such a thing? Are you all familiar with how to integrate such a thing? So you're integrating a one form. This is just Rn. Actually, it's R2. But how would you integrate such a thing, a function times dx1 plus a function times dx2, over the boundary of our region? This needs to be integrated over del g. Well, look at your boundary and write it as a path. So you define a function from a gamma from an interval into the boundary. So imagine you're traveling along the boundary with a time parameter. So you have a map, maps the time into your point on the boundary. So here we have a path, gamma, which gives you the points on the boundary. Gamma of t is x1 of t and x2 of t. It's really a chart. We are mapping the boundary del g into R, and from R into the boundary. Well, and then we can use that dxi can be written as dxi by dt, dt. So in particular then, up here, the dx1 can be written as dx1 by dt multiplied with dt. And that becomes dx2 differentiated with respect to the path parameter dt multiplied with dt. And then it's just function times dt plus function times dt. It's just a t integral, and you can work out the whole thing. Similarly here, but a dimension higher. Just need a chart that maps the whole thing into R2 in the same way that this mapped everything into R1. Instead of a path, you have a map into the entire region a two-parameter map into the entire region of G. There's a special case of Green's theorem. So Green's theorem is a special case of Stokes' theorem for two dimensions, namely, and R2. But it too has a special case that is super important. Also, I have to leave a little bit of a loose end, but here's how it goes. Let's assume that our differential one form is actually a closed one form. Remember what that is, a closed one form? It's d of the one form is vanishing. So d omega is 0. And that means that d omega 1 by dx2 minus the other way around is equal to 0. Why? Because, well, remember, we calculated what d omega is. This is the omega. Here it is. D omega is this. So for it to vanish, we must have that this differential equation is vanishing. That this is a differential equation for the coefficient functions. Omega 2 is a function of x1 and x2, and so is omega 1. And so what we are saying is that this differential equation, this is a differential equation, this vanishing. This term equal to 0 all over the manifold means that this differential form is closed, that omega is closed, that d omega is vanishing. If that differential equation holds, well, then Stokes' theorem in the form of Green's theorem here simplifies, because then the integral over the R2, over the region in R2, the integral over G of the two-form d omega vanishes, because d omega vanishes, right? We have here this. If d omega is zero, well, then we just have that the integral over the boundary of omega is equal to zero. So we get this for Green's theorem as a special case of Stokes' theorem. So let's see what we have. We have that if the differential form obeys a particular differential equation, namely that it is closed, which is a differential equation for the coefficient functions, then if I integrate this differential form over any closed curve, that could be the boundary of some region, then I get zero. This is reminiscent of what we have in complex analysis. Complex analysis, we have functions from R2 into R2. And we can identify them with, I mean, sorry, in complex analysis, we have functions from C into C. But we can identify C with R2. So complex valued functions on the complex plane can be viewed as functions from R2 into R2. Real part plus imaginary part going into real and imaginary part. And if you remember, if a complex valued function is what is called holomorphic or synonymously analytic, then you can integrate it in a circle or any other closed boundary in the complex plane and the integral will be zero. So here's the residues theorem. If a function which is defined on a region in the complex plane, into this complex plane, is holomorphic, or which is also to say analytic, then we say it obeys the Cauchy-Riemann equations. That's the condition for holomorphicity or analyticity. So if it obeys the Cauchy-Riemann differential equations, then that contour integral in the complex plane will vanish. In fact, that's not a coincidence. You can view the condition that the Cauchy-Riemann differential equations hold for complex functions on the complex plane through the condition that a differential 2 form vanishes, that the d of the differential 1 form vanishes, the differential equation that we had above. Except there's one little loose end. We worked here with a real only, and we only get half of the Cauchy theorem here. In order to get the full Cauchy theorem here, which is to say that if you have an analytic function and you integrate it over a closed contour in the complex plane, then the integral is zero. In order to get the full thing, we would have to require that our differential form is both closed and co-closed. But we haven't defined co-closedness yet. It will come up in the next like two, at most three lectures. And of course, if you remember, Cauchy's theorem is generalized if the function is not analytic, if the function has points where it is singular, then you get that this is not zero, but on the right-hand side, you have these residues. And so then you get the residue theorem. So just to remind you, what we were talking about here is the special case of the residue theorem, where the functions in question don't have residues. We guaranteed that by requiring that these functions are holomorphic in the entire region there. They have to be holomorphic, or also said analytic, in the entire region enclosed by del G. There are more special cases. This one I will just list. I leave it to you as a little exercise to verify it, if you like. And it should also connect with something that you know from electromagnetism. Now we upgrade to R3. Remember, we did R1, that was just the fundamental theorem of calculus. R2, we got Green's theorem and the Cauchy-Riemann equations and the Cauchy contour integration formula. Now in R3, what do we get if we apply Stokes' theorem? So there we obtain what is often called Stokes' theorem in electromagnetism. It's a specialization to R3. Here we have that omega, or I think here I wrote W's, it's omegas. So imagine omega, assume omega is a one form. So it's a covector field. Then you can define what in electromagnetism is often used, namely the so-called cross product with Nabla, with the derivatives. If you're not familiar with it, it's not going to be important for the rest of the course because we will do things more abstractly then. But if you remember, that gives you the curl of a vector field. And so if you have a vector field and you take the exterior derivative of it, you get a two form. So this is a one form, it's a covector field, and this is a two form. And this two form has an anti-symmetrization in it. It's actually the curl. The curl is the map that gets you from covectors to their exterior derivative. And then Stokes' theorem tells us that, you see, yeah, right, okay, tells us that if you integrate your one form over a one-dimensional boundary of some two form, namely the Nabla of omega, of some two form of that region, so typically this would be like, I don't know, you have a current going through a wire that's closed, and you have a magnetic field that goes through that loop. You can have an integration over an area that bounds that ring. And so you have then here an integral over the area, and here an integral over just the ring. And then Stokes' theorem tells us, if you just plug these things in there, it tells us that the integral over that two-dimensional two-form here, two-dimensional integral over that two-form is given by the one-dimensional integral over just the ring, just the boundary of that one-form. What we also see here is that when you take the cross product in this way, in electromagnetism, then you don't actually get a vector. Usually, I mean, it looks like it is a vector because it has three components. But if you remember the Nabla cross vector field, it just looks like a three-component vector field, but it isn't. And we can see that here, because what it really is a two-form. It just so happens that in three dimensions, a two-form has three components. And so it can easily be mistaken for a vector, but it isn't. Its transformation properties are a little different. Okay, so by the way, whenever you have questions, please ask, because I keep moving on to new things now, and let me know if there's something. So finally, we are about to approach the so-called Gauss theorem. And usually in electromagnetism, Gauss theorem and Stokes' theorem are set side by side, but it turns out Gauss' theorem is also a special case of Stokes' theorem. But we need one more ingredient for this. We need the volume form that we had defined earlier. We defined a volume form earlier. We said it's a top form, it's an N form in an N-dimensional manifold that is always positive, because we don't want volumes to turn out to be negative. So we take a volume form, and using that we can define now Gauss's theorem. But we need still a bit more preparation. First, let's remind ourselves Or let's just view, let's just check what is a volume form good for? Well, in Rn, we define the volume to be literally this. We just integrate dx1 to dxn in the Riemann or Lebesgue sense over the region, and then what you obtain, you call V the volume. In a general manifold, we can't be so naive as to do this, because this singles out a particular coordinate system. In a different coordinate system, the same integral will look very different, because it will have a Jacobian factor in this. So in general, we will need to choose a volume form which is, of course, coordinate system independently defined. It's an object that lives in lambda n, which takes different explicit forms, in particular explicit charts, but it's one object. And if you integrate that one object, you always get the same number out of it. If you integrate an n form over an n dimensional manifold, you get the same number no matter which coordinate system you choose. So that's why we work with the volume form. It guarantees that we get the same volume no matter what coordinate system we choose. Whereas if we just adopted this definition, well, then the answer would depend on what coordinate system we chose. Okay, so we choose a volume form, so it's always positive. And then the volume of a region of the manifold is defined to be the integral over our volume form, which is, after all, an n form, over this n-dimensional region in our manifold. In principle, we can choose this volume form any which way we want. And later on in general relativity, this will be a point that we'll have to address. We will introduce a so-called metric to define the notion of distance. And you might think that once I have distances, well, I can take a distance in this direction, that direction, that direction. I can define a volume. But it turns out that you can define distances and the notion of metric whichever way you want, and you still have the freedom to define your volume form any which way you want. As a matter of mathematical possibilities, the choice of volume form and metric are independent choices. In general relativity, we will find that the physics tells us that we should link the definition of volume to the definition of length. But as a mathematical matter, they could be chosen separately. I'm mentioning this because similar things happen all over physics. For example, the momentum is usually thought of as the mass times x dot, right? Mass times velocity. And so one might think, well, okay, so why introduce the notion of momentum at all? Can we just work with x and its derivative? And the answer is no, it is very useful to have p and to think of it as an independent variable, because sometimes it happens that the momentum is not m times x dot. For example, when there's a magnetic field present, then it's not. Then you have m times x dot plus e times a being the vector potential. And so sometimes it happens that there are two concepts that are almost always the same thing, but sometimes maybe they are not. And so I'm just mentioning this because some of you may be working on generalizing general relativity eventually, and then I'm just saying that this is an opening there. I don't know whether it's useful, whether this comes up, but it's one of those things that is usually just taken for granted. Of course, we choose our volume form to come from the metric, but you know, there could be quantum fluctuations around this identification. It could be on average the same, but maybe not always. Okay, remember we said earlier that if a manifold is orientable, then it means that it has a volume form. In fact, infinitely many. Okay, so now we know how to calculate the volume of a manifold. Okay, special case 4, Gauss's theorem. This is still we're still preparing for it. Sorry. I'm already saying Gauss's theorem, but here's the we need some more preparation for it. We need to define a new kind of derivative, as if we hadn't had enough derivatives yet. And there will be more derivatives coming up too. But now we need another derivative. It's called the divergence of a vector field. You've heard about it before, and this is how the divergence normally looks like on Rn. If psi is a vector field, then the divergence of psi is defined in this way. You take the first component, differentiate it with respect to the first coordinate, plus dxi2 by dx2 plus dx3 by dx3. Dxi3 by dx3. And that's the divergence of a vector field. For example, for an electric field, it tells you the charges. If there are no charges, the electric field has no divergence. And the charge density is the divergence of the electric field. It's one of the Maxwell equations. So in our notation, we can write this as I subscript comma I. Just to make this a little faster to write. Right? So Einstein summation convention, twice occurring indices summed over, etc. We need to generalize this notion, make it covariant, make it independent of coordinate systems, make it work on any kind of manifold. How can we generalize that? So we need something that generalizes this idea, that we take the components of a vector field and then differentiate them in their respective directions and sum that up. In order to identify how we can do that, let us remember that we have seen something similar occur previously. It was a little bit hidden, so we have to dig it up. Remember how the Lie derivative works. If tau is a tensor field, so tau has indices, R contravariant indices, and S covariant indices, then the Lie derivative of it, same thing, the Lie derivative will have R upper and S lower indices. Remember that the Lie derivative maintains the rank of tensors. But we also calculated what it is when spelled out. And what we obtain is that the Lie derivative of our tensor field is given by the ordinary derivative of the tensor field, namely comma k means d by dx k. So it's the derivative of the tensor field times the vector field in which we are differentiating, psi, undifferentiated. And that's no use for us, for our purposes. We need psi i comma i. That's what we need. And our first term here is no good for that, because we're not differentiating psi. But look at this here. Here we have the tensor tau undifferentiated, but we have the psi differentiated. So that tells us that we might be on the right track if we calculate the Lie derivative of something. The psi has to be down there, but what should be up here? Well, if we put something up here, which in the case of Rn that we had earlier was simply constant, well, then that term would go away. Because the tensor would be constant, this goes away, and we're just left with this, and with a little luck, the indices will arrange themselves and we get the gradient, and we get the divergence. And this is in fact how it will work out. So we choose tau to be the only canonical thing we have living on the manifold so far, and that is the volume form. Let's see how far we get with this. If we choose tau to be the volume form, and on Rn, we would want it to be constant, right? So the amount of volume I accumulate on a flat Rn should be the same everywhere. So the volume form should have a prefactor, omega of x, which is just constant. So that would be good, because then the Lie derivative first term vanishes. Okay, so we choose for tau to be the volume form. And in Rn, that means that the volume form is simply 1 times dx1 to dxn, and then this 1 means that the first term in the Lie derivative goes away. And so we may be generalizing this thing that we want. So let's see. In fact, we will succeed by defining the following. The divergence of a vector field psi, the divergence of a vector field psi with respect to a volume form, and the divergence is always defined with respect to a volume form, The divergence of a vector field psi with respect to a volume form is defined to be this. Divergence of a vector field psi with respect to the volume form is the Lie derivative of the volume form in the direction of psi. It's not intuitive at all, at least I don't have a good intuition for why we should Lie differentiate the volume form. But technically, we see how this works, right? Because in Rn, this omega is constant. If we choose the usual volume form on Rn, omega is constant, the first term in the Lie derivative drops out, and the second term can deliver the divergence that we want. And also, yes, the divergence is relative to our choice of volume form, but keep in mind that we don't make this choice very often. Basically, we will make this choice once. We will later in GR say that we choose the volume form to be the volume that's induced from the length notion that comes with a metric, and then we'll be done with it. And then we no longer talk of divergence relative to volume forms anymore. We will just assume it is, of course, relative to volume form. It's always the same volume form, the one that comes from the metric. But to be entirely clear about it, it is dependent on what we choose for the volume form. Okay, so let's see whether we recover. I mean, this is definitely something that is coordinate system independent. It is a definition that lives on the abstract manifold. Now we only have to check whether we recover what we wanted to recover, namely the old notion of divergence on Rn. And then we are happy with that. And then we can finally do Gauss's theorem. Okay, so omega over volume form is A of x times the top form. All volume forms can be written in this way. This is lambda zero form. It's just a function. And our vector field always has this expansion, right? This is coefficient function times basis vector. Remember, these are the basis vectors in the tangent spaces. So now, the divergence of psi relative to omega is the Lie derivative of omega in the direction of psi. And what is that? Well, the Lie derivative is going to act on the A of x, and because it's a derivation, but it's also going to act on those terms here. Right? So we have the Lie derivative acting first on this function here. But what's the Lie derivative on a scalar function? Remember, we defined Lie derivatives on zero forms, on functions, and we defined Lie derivatives on one forms, and the rest was induced. And we define the Lie derivative to be the directional derivative on everything, right? But in particular on functions. But what is the directional derivative on functions? It's a tangent vector. So we defined the Lie derivative, L psi, of a function like that to be psi itself, the tangent vector, acting on that function. So it's psi of A. That's the Lie derivative of a function. It's just applying the vector of the Lie derivative directly to the function itself. Okay, by the Leibniz rule, we differentiate this one, Lie differentiate this one, leaving that the same, plus, and then we get terms where we leave the A the same, and we differentiate, we differentiate each one of those factors, leaving the other factors the same. So we have to work out what the Lie derivative is of those basis vectors in the cotangent space, dxi. All right, so I worked it out over here. The Lie derivative of a cotangent vector is, if you remember, so we have the Lie derivative of a gradient. Remember, the d of a function is called the gradient of the function. So here, xi is a coordinate function, d of xi is the gradient of the coordinate function. If you remember how we defined the action of the Lie derivative on one form, we said that on the basis of one form, we said that the Lie derivative on the gradient is the gradient of the Lie derivative. And that's how we define that. So the Lie derivative of the gradient is, take the Lie derivative of the coordinate function, which is psi acting on the coordinate function, and then take the gradient later. Remember, that was part of this scheme. We defined the Lie derivative's action on functions, and we defined the Lie derivative's action on a basis of one form, namely this one, and then the rest was induced by the Leibniz rule. And we defined the action of the lead derivative on these particular one forms on gradient fields by saying that the lead derivative of the gradient should be the gradient of the lead derivative. Okay, so we have this. Now, let's spell out what this gradient vector, what this tangent vector field is. Well, the tangent vector field is psi j coefficient functions times these basis vectors here. And this tangent vector field is supposed to eat this function, this coordinate function, and outputs a function, and that's what it does. So what do we get here? We get psi j, derivative of this, which gives us a Kronecker delta. And the Kronecker delta is here, psi j carried forward, the d carried forward. Now this sum has only one surviving term because it's the Kronecker delta, which is the psi I. So we get d of psi I. And d of psi I is the gradient of the function psi I. So it's d psi I by dxr dxr. Okay, so this sum now goes into here. We calculated the lead derivative of the dxr. But in fact, out of that sum, you know, we have all basis vectors, only one term will survive. The one where r is equal to I, because all the other terms would be repeated somewhere, and therefore by anti-symmetry they go away. All right, so what we have is that it is dxi by dx, by dxi and the dxi there. So, putting it all together, we obtain that the divergence of a vector field is given by this expression here. We have the psi of A, which is this. Psi of A is vector field applied to function. So it's these partial derivatives of the function times psi I, that's this, psi I, A comma I, plus A times, and then these guys here, and they are psi I xi, because only the I term survives. All the others will go away. Times this long list of the dx1 to the dxn. And these are actually obtained by just taking that expression, taking one derivative. You see, you have either this not differentiated and that differentiated, or that one not differentiated and this one differentiated. So overall, it's just A times psi differentiated. You get those two terms. So the divergence of a vector field relative to the volume form omega is given by this. And then just to anticipate, later the volume form will be given by A being grad of G. And so then the divergence of a vector field will be calculated in this way, but this particular function A that we use to define our volume form up here will be square root of the determinant of G, the metric. Anyway, for now, we don't need a metric. We can just use any volume form and we can calculate the divergence. So in particular, if A, the volume form, simply has it as its coefficient function 1, as we would have in electromagnetism on Minkowski space, then A is 1, here's 1, and then you see it's just psi I comma I. It's just the usual divergence times dx1 to dxn. So now finally we are ready to derive Gauss's theorem from Stokes' theorem. So we know that the divergence of a vector field is the lead derivative of the volume form by construction. And it is an n form. From electromagnetism, you might have thought that the divergence of a vector field is a function. Right? You take dx1 of E1 plus dx2 of E2 when you take the divergence of the electric field plus dx3 by E3, and you get something which just like it looks like a scalar function on R3. But it's not. It's actually an n-form. N-forms is also one-dimensional, so they look like they behave like functions, but they don't have the same transformation properties. So the divergence is an n-form. It's this n-form. And it turns out that the divergence can be written, therefore, like that. The reason being that the Lie derivative had this form. We define the Lie derivative, of course, for all tensors. And it's not true for all tensors, but for differential forms, it's true that the Lie derivative takes this particular form. This was one of the formulas we had in the previous lecture. But this particular form simplifies now, because omega is a top form, it's an end form. So if you apply the D to it, that term goes away. So we're just left with this. And so what we have is that the divergence of a vector field is the D of something. And that's why we are in business now with Gauss. Because we have a vector field constructed, and we have from a vector field, we constructed an end form which is the D of an n minus 1 form. This one. Okay? And so we can now use Stokes. We can say that instead of having the D act on that and integrate it over, instead of using the D, we can put a del on the integration region. So what we have is that instead of integrating here, the D of that n minus 1 form, you see this is an n form, because that's an n minus 1 form. Instead of integrating that over the n-dimensional manifold, we might as well integrate this without the D, but instead having the co-boundary operator, having the boundary operator here. Instead of using the co-boundary here, we can use the boundary operator there. That's what Stokes' theorem says. So, so Stokes' theorem is this, but in particular now, this is saying that the divergence of because this is the divergence of a vector field. The divergence of a vector field integrated over an n-dimensional manifold can also be calculated by calculating just this thing here, the inner derivation, acting on the volume form over just the boundary of it, just the surface of it. So this could be a three-dimensional ball in 3D. G could be the region with just a three-dimensional ball. And we integrate the divergence of the electric field, which is the charges. So we integrate up the charges. And then the Maxwell equations would tell us that, or actually Gauss's equation tells us that, we can obtain the same thing by integrating not the divergence of the electric field, but the electric field itself over the boundary of that ball, over the surface of it. And in this way, we can find out how many charges there are. In there. So the integral over the divergence of a vector field over a region is given by, it's the same value as if we integrated just the inner derivation of the volume form in the direction of the vector field in question over this, of the boundary over that region. And this is not tied to three dimensions. It works in any amount of dimensions. We never chose n equal 3 in this. So far we have a lot of differentiations. We have that vector fields are directional derivatives. The exterior derivative is a derivation. The inner derivation is a derivation on the algebra of differential forms, same here. The Lie derivative is a derivation on the algebra of differential forms, but it's also a derivation on the tensor algebra of tensors. And now we have another derivative, the divergence. The divergence is not a derivation, but it's a derivative. And then we also had integration. And even though we had all of these concepts, we still don't have a notion of distance yet. And so the next thing we'll do is introduce the metric. But keep in mind that all of what we've done so far is metric independent. So Gauss, Stokes, Green, complex integration, Lie derivatives, all of those things are true even before we define a metric. And that means in particular, for example, let me just make this last point, which is a little bit surprising. If you look at the Lie derivative, where is it? There it is. Lie derivative. See, it has these derivatives here. The tensor gets differentiated, the vector field gets differentiated, and so on, right? These formulas are true, before we even define what the metric is. Now, later, we will define the metric, and we will find it very important. But if you then want to calculate the Lie derivative, remember, you don't need the metric for that. This is how you can calculate it. In particular, you don't have to use semicolons here. You don't have to use covariant derivatives. Ordinary derivatives will do. And you will find that all of the things that we did before, I mean, so far, we have not used covariant derivatives. We haven't used affine connections or metrics. All of these formulas stay true, even in the presence of a metric, because the metric is just an additional structure. And here we just see that we can do these things that much without it. There's also the argument that we will later get that you can replace, in order to covariantize equations for general relativity, take the ordinary derivatives and replace them by covariant ones. Funny thing is, you can do that even here. You can take your Lie derivative and put covariant derivatives, it's still true. It's the same thing. But it's important to realize that you don't have to use covariant derivatives. In fact, it would be a little foolish to do because you get so many more terms to no effect, because the Lie derivative already gives you the right answer this way. Anyway, so that's as far as we got today. And on Thursday, we'll do the metric and what follows from that. Yeah. Any questions?